Hello, it's Saturday, August 12th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing Radio. And yes, you heard Lisa correctly. It is a Saturday. We're taping this show today because our guest, Mr. L. Hedel, who's the co-editor of Paranoia Magazine, this is the only way we could fit things in. His schedule is as busy as ours, that's for sure. So what we're going to do is tape this today and then either broadcast it Wednesday or Thursday of next week. You'll know what day it is when it's played. So what we want to do is bring on L. Hedel today, and we're going to talk about the magazine that he publishes. It's one of the best in the country. So we'd like to welcome Mr. L. Hedel to Wing TV. How are you doing, Al?
Welcome, Al.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're
Thanks
welcome.
For being here.
Now, as I said, Al, you're the co-editor of Paranoia Magazine. The fall 2006 edition is now on the newsstands. And I'd also like to thank Al because in the most recent edition, he included me or referenced me in one of the articles on the Alabama church burnings that have been happening and have been, it seems, covered up. But Al, to start off today, tell us about Paranoia Magazine. When you started it, how you really began it.
And how people can get it.
Exactly.
Okay, back in 1993, or thereabouts, I started hanging out in an alternative bookstore in Providence, Rhode Island, called Newspeak, and formed a conspiracy discussion group, Conspiracy League, and people started bringing in articles and submissions that we put in a big red binder, and I had a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald on the front of the binder, and the binder began to rip. So I said, well, maybe we should start a magazine. So it started as a project of the Conspiracy League, and my partner, Joan Dark, who ran the bookstore at that time, her and I teamed up and created the first issue, and we were fortunate enough to get a distributor to distribute the magazine to newsstands, and from then on, and it hasn't been an international multimedia success, but fairly successful. We've been able to, fortunate enough to keep on doing it.
And how can people find your website so they can subscribe to this magazine?
It's www.paranoiamagazine.com.
All right, very
Great.
Good.
Al, if you had to name the conspiracy of all time, what would it be?
Oh, gee. You know what, I would say that it would be the it would be the covert influence of secret societies on our political leaders and our world leaders. That's mm-hmm. really been pretty much the big one.
Yeah.
I would say pretty much since day one.
And when you
and
say
also their influence on popular culture.
Yeah. Well, when you say covert secret societies, what specifically would you be referring to?
I would be referring to the followers of the Kabbalah, the Freemasons, of course, and there are a lot of similar groups, as you know, that were kind of offshoots of the Freemasons or inspired by the Freemasons, such as Skull and Bones out of Yale University, and Scroll and Key is another similar group. So basically shadowy groups of powerful people working behind the scenes.
Yeah. Now, as you can probably tell, we haven't given any advanced questions to Al, and what we're going to do is look at not only some of the old issues of his magazine, but also the current issue. And Al, in the current fall issue, you have an interview with Tex Mars, who we've interviewed numerous times. We're going to meet him next month down in Washington, D.C. And I want to relay this quote from his interview. He says, "I don't intend to apologize for exposing evil, no matter the form or disguise in which it is cloaked." It was probably the best interview I'd ever read with
Tex Mars.
I love
that he said that.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about how that came about and what your impressions were of this interview with Tex Mars.
Well, I've always liked Tex Mars' books and had always wanted to interview him. And it turned out that our one of our layout designers, Devin LaRue, was also a big Tex Mars fan, so Devin took on the task of contacting Tex and setting up the interview. wanting to have in the magazine for a long time, and then it turned out that an associate was also interested in doing it, and that's really how it came about.
Well, really, it came out great.
Al, in a couple of different issues of Paranoia magazine, you covered something known as Alternative 3, which was based on an English TV show that was broadcast on April Fool's Day. Many people think this was just a spoof or a parody or a put-on, but others think there's more to it. What are your thoughts on it?
You know what? I'll give you a short and simple answer. I think it was a spoof or a put-on.
Yeah?
I'm not super knowledgeable about Alternative 3, but...
That was your impression?
That was my gut feeling.
All right, very good. Now, probably the favorite article of mine that I've ever read in Paranoia magazine was one about Chappaquiddick and Teddy Kennedy.
Yep.
And I'm not sure how much you remember about this article. I think it was about 10 years ago or so.
Yeah.
But the specifics in it is that it takes a lot different slant than the conventional wisdom on this, where, you know, Teddy Kennedy was drunk and just drove his car over the bridge into the river. What did this article convey, and what differences were there from the official story?
I think the article, I think, as I recall, the article looked at a lot of the physics and the accident reconstruction aspects of Chappaquiddick, and the author concluded that essentially the Chappaquiddick crash, as it had been described, was physically impossible.
Uh-huh.
So I believe he spent most of the article reconstructing an alternative hypothesis as to how the accident could have been actually caused by outside actors.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, if I remember correctly, that there were more parties involved than just Teddy Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne. So it was very interesting, and it seems as if that she was in this car for an extended period of time, and that she could have, her life could have been saved, but, you know, obviously it wasn't to, I guess, destroy his career or whatever, but...
Yeah.
Many people in the so-called Patriot Movement, Al, tend to shy away from UFOs, but your magazine has dealt with this subject quite extensively. Is there one specific UFO case or phenomenon that stands out in your mind that's not easily debunked by skeptics?
Well, I have to confess that I am a skeptic when it comes to UFOs.
Uh-huh.
In terms of the craft that have been cited being from other planets having other living beings on them.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I'm certainly not a skeptic when it comes to the idea of intelligent life existing throughout the universe. My take on the UFO phenomena is more along the lines of that there may be, especially abductions and such, they may be government corporate operations, experiments, mind control experiments, and kind of new secret technologies of light technologies and that type of thing. So in my case, my take on that is more earthbound, you might say.
Uh-huh.
But I am a big believer in intelligent life in the universe.
All right, very good. Now, another interview that you did in your magazine, this one is available online on your site. It was done by your co-editor, Joan D'Arc. And it was with Mr. Michael Hoffman, who's the author of Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. And the name of the interview was The Scapegoating of Ted Kaczynski, Serial Murder and the Group Mind. And this interview was so good that I even referenced it or touched upon it in my latest book, 9/11 Evil. What were your thoughts about this whole Unabomber case and how it played into a bigger picture of mind think, group mind think, and also the government?
I wasn't as interested in the Unabomber aspect of Hoffman's theory, but I definitely agree with his group think mind theory, which is basically he says that the Illuminati or the other hidden controllers kind of stage manage these extreme, violent, unexpected, or you know, I sometimes have trouble with in my own mind, as I debated in my own mind, and perhaps you might as well, is he seems to kind of think that conspiracy theory, you know, websites like yours and ours and conspiracy theory magazines that focus on providing, getting the information out there on different conspiracies, kind of miss the point in a way, or feed into the kind of mythology that our hidden rulers want to create in terms of creating a sense of powerlessness, that they're invincible, and that type of thing. And I sometimes wonder about that. If by providing small pieces of the big picture, do we in some way unintentionally help promote that big picture that we're trying to stop?
Well, let me run this by one of the points that Hoffman brings up is that this new world order, the global elite, or whatever you want to call it, the cryptocracy, I guess is the name he gives it, for them to be completely successful at the end of the line is for them to come out and actually state the conspiracy before it even happens, to state the crimes before it even happens, and say basically, what are you going to do about that? Now, we obviously haven't reached that point yet, but do you put any validity in that argument?
I think there is some validity to it because I see a trend of increasing exposure of conspiracies, increasing discussion, even in the mainstream media about conspiracies, and just general kind of explosion of conspiracy news sources and such. So it's almost like the public is becoming more accepting of conspiracies, which I think is good because it encourages skepticism.
Right, exactly.
At the same time, that could be fitting into Hoffman's scenario of the cryptocracy becoming kind of bolder and bolder, and finally kind of saying we don't have to cover up our conspiracies. They're right out in the open, and you can't do anything about them.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
Al. What do you make about certain figures in the so-called 9/11 truth movement getting a lot of FaceTime on mainstream TV networks, especially now that I think Paul Joseph Watson wrote something about Christiane Amanpour kind of linking the Muslim terrorists with 9/11 truthers.
I had not seen that report.
I just got it today.
Were you thinking of specific, you want to know what I think of the general trend of mainstream media being more open to 9/11.
Right.
And their spin on it.
I think in a way though I generally am skeptical of the way the idea that the media follows public opinion or public thinking, and that it generally seems to create it more so. I have noticed, and I've seen in some recent polls that about a third of Americans now do, that federal officials took part in the 9/11 attacks or knew about them and failed to stop them. And at the same time, I have read that we're seeing increasing kind of disgust with the government. So basically the public is becoming a lot more cynical, a lot more skeptical, a lot less trusting of the government. And with the Internet in particular and other alternative information resources like yourself, the information is just getting out there to such a degree that maybe in the case of 9/11, that the mainstream media can't completely ignore it.
Right.
And when they don't ignore it, or more often than not, they mock it, or they kind of use a straw man argument and bring up one of the a ridiculous theory about 9/11. It could be part of Hoffman's scenario as well. They're allowing 9/11 conspiracies to gain credence and giving them wider exposure along the lines of we did it and there's nothing you can do about it. Scenario.
Yeah. Another area of interest paranoia has focused on is violence and the occult. So what I'd like you to do is just give us some of your thoughts on people like Aleister Crowley, Charles Manson, and the McMartin sex scandal.
Yeah, these were all covered in your magazine. So what are your thoughts on those individuals or that one event?
My thinking on McMartin, McMartin was representative of, I believe that they did find tunnels, for example, under
right.
And some artifacts and such. But in a way, I think the focus on what you might call small-time satanic ritual abuse, I use that term, blinds people from the fact that there are more powerful, more organized ritual abuse activities that might be going on. So I've focused more in my own reading on the more organized, the more powerful groups
uh-huh.
doing these kind of things. But I do think there was something going on at McMartin. I think Crowley, and it's pretty clear that he was an intelligence agent and acting, in a capacity where he wasn't just acting alone. He was engaged in a group activity. And my gut, I mean, I'm not an expert on Crowley and Satanism and such. My gut tells me that it promotes essentially an idea of, like you said, just what thou wilt.
Yeah.
Want. There is, everything is morally equivalent. There is no right or wrong. And what's always puzzled me about theories that talk about the promotion of that kind of philosophy is that it's kind of like once you let the horse out of the barn, you can't always control what he does.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, our rulers may want to promote chaos and uncertainty and fear by unleashing, satanic killers and such on the population. But on the other hand, an authoritarian ruler would want to have a set of strict yes and no rules, want to encourage people to think, narrow lines of right and wrong.
Well, exactly. Kind of like the 1960s when they flooded the youth culture with LSD and it spun, I think, beyond their grasp. But let's move on to something else here. In numerous issues of your magazine, including the current one, it's on the newsstands now, you look at AIDS not as some sort of random disease aberration that just suddenly popped up from the African green monkey, but it was something much more sinister and man-made that reached the top levels of government, military, the World Health Organizations. What wouldn't the everyday person on the street know about AIDS if you buy into this as a man-made disease?
I think that a lot of people aren't aware of something that was called the virus cancer program, which President Nixon created in 1971. It was essentially an army biowarfare program that was merged with the National Cancer Institute. And you have to think, why would the government be looking to create cancer-causing viruses? And that establishes that the government was working on artificially creating, killer viruses. And in the case of cancer, obviously, a person's immune system is kind of selectively disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, AIDS is the whole kind of point of AIDS is to reduce someone's immune system.
Right.
So I think they put the connection there between the early 1970s cancer-causing viruses, which were experimented on in monkeys, as a matter of fact.
And then the clinics in New York City and San Francisco and Los Angeles where AIDS broke out, and then also the vaccinations in Africa. So it all seems to be linked together that, these three cities where these clinics were set up, those are the three places where AIDS explodes the most and then spreads out from there. So,
Al, we think that one of the most intriguing and macabre cases ever was the Jonestown Massacre, where the official story says that 900-plus people drank poison Kool-Aid from a vat, yet when you look deeper into it and scrutinize it closer, it appears these people were actually murdered. A lot of them were shot. They had needle marks from syringes. What's your take on it?
Well, kind of the easy answer is that I think it was some kind of mind control
right.
exercise or experiment.
We think so, too.
Yeah, and I think so. And I think and something that hasn't really been exposed to a great degree is how powerful Jim Jones was and how connected he was to the San Francisco political scene prior to starting his Jonestown establishment.
And also to the CIA and different intel. We just saw a video a couple weeks ago that links him directly to the CIA. So this guy was very much an insider.
We think that it was actually a spinoff of MKUltra, especially when you look at the timeline when MKUltra was supposed to have stopped and then when the Jonestown people started arriving there.
You know what? That makes a lot of sense, in particular when you know, Congress prohibited a lot of the MKUltra stuff. I'm not sure, but I suspect that there were some prohibitions regarding you know, doing these things within the United States.
Well, it was like the next year that people started going to Guyana.
Yes, and so they weren't doing it in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So there were less government, there was less government oversight, less control, and maybe they were technically not in violation of some of the
right.
Yeah, and it turned out to be very, very messy, especially when Congressman Leo Ryan went down there and got shot. Now, on the cover of your latest edition, the cover says, "Are we conspiracy geeks?" And this was written by Joan D'Arc. And she's asking several people, yourself included, also Adam Gorightly and others, you know, their thoughts on this whole conspiracy field. And I remember the first instant, like it was yesterday, this was in early 1990 when I was living in Los Angeles, when someone gave me a Bill Cooper videotape. And from that moment, my life completely changed. Then I remember in the fall of 2001 when Lisa came here and I started showing this stuff to her, and it completely changed her perspective on the world. And it seems like it's whenever you get this stuff in your blood, it's like you can't unring a bell.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this conspiracy field? And it's, once you take a step forward, it's hard to look back again, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In my case, it was my moment came when seeing the Cruder film during the second Kennedy assassination hearing, the House Select Committee on Assassination hearing. And I was just a kid then, but I remember PBS showed a really, it was like black and white, and it was really hard to make out, but they showed the Cruder film, and the assassination kind of took place in the lower west corner of the black and white TV I was watching, and it wasn't nearly as detailed or as, you know, analyzed as the Zapruder film videos that would come out later.
Uh-huh.
But that just stunned me that, you know, someone blew the head off of JFK.
Yeah.
And that kind of got me started, and then similar to someone giving you the Bill Cooper video, in college someone gave me some just really bizarre conspiracy pamphlets. I don't even remember who published them. And also gave me a copy of the book, Illuminati, by Neil Wilkins.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, like you say, once you get some of that content, some of that material, once you're informed of it, if you're interested, you just keep going. You can't just leave it.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mind control and subliminal advertising. How prevalent do you think these techniques are in movies, commercials, print ads, programming overall, in general?
You know, I believe there's really no hard data, but I would say maybe, I don't know, 25% of the data out there. And again, of that percent, you know, what percent is essentially limited to kind of basic capitalist consumer control goals, and then what percent is more sinister? Right? You know, I can't.
Well, there's an article in your current issue where it's from a cigarette advertiser, I believe, and you have a big picture and then you have a close-up. And in the big picture, you don't really see anything, but you see a man's hand on this woman's back. She has a bareback dress on. But then when you look at the close-up, you see this penis-shaped object in his hand running up along her back. And even that, the print, it said something about you're soft and then hard or something, like hard pack and soft pack. And it was really intriguing what this was. And I know, like, there's been Disney movies and other things like that that put this stuff in there.
Yeah.
And, once you know how to look for it, it's pretty interesting. Well, I got one more question for you, but before we leave today, again, give everybody your website address and, let them know. We urge them to take a look at it, subscribe to Paranoia. And how often does it come out these days now?
We publish 3 times a year.
Okay.
In August, December, and April.
Okay.
And a one-year subscription is $15, or it's available on newsstands at places like Borders and Barnes & Noble. Cover price is $6 an issue.
All right, very good.
We also have some back issues on our website as well as a lot of articles. And that site is ParanoiaMagazine.com.
All right, ParanoiaMagazine.com.
It's a great magazine.
Yeah. Take a look at it, and they have a lot of articles on their website itself, just to kind of show you what you have. But to close out, I don't even remember how long this was, 5 or 6 years ago. I went to a lecture by Larry Flint. He was at Penn State University here near where we live. And, of course, he's the publisher of Hustler magazine. And he gave his presentation. It was about the First Amendment. But then he took questions afterwards. So there was a long line of people, and they were asking him about various things, and he was very, very glib, very open, very talkative, or so about all of the questions. And finally, I got to the microphone, and I asked him about the assassination of John Kennedy and its relationship to the Gemstone Files. And I know you've run articles about that. And the only question of the whole night is Larry Flint got real silent, kind of shot me a dark glance, and really didn't have a whole lot to say about the Gemstone Files. So tell people that aren't familiar what the Gemstone Files were and how they related to the Kennedy assassination and bigger to even the Onassis family.
The Gemstone Files were a manuscript which purported to give kind of a detailed, intricate portrait of the Kennedy assassination and the cabal who was behind it. It's been a while since I've read it. I can't really comment on the particular aspects of it.
That's okay.
But I do know it was probably one of the most detailed conspiracy theories about the JFK assassination, and it kind of had the kind of underground cachet because it was originally, I believe, distributed very small quantity of various researchers.
Yeah, it was one of the first big underground classics where it was just, run off on mimeograph machines or whatever, and then it got into Larry Flint's hands, and some people say that even his attempted assassination where he got crippled was a result of the Gemstone Files, and he was supposed to publish one version in his magazine first. But then later on, after he got shot, he published a more watered down version of it. So who knows if it was actually a result of the Gemstone Files, but he got a very strange look on his face and clammed up when I asked him that question.
So he didn't answer you?
No, he was like, he just kind of like just stumbled over it and then quickly moved on to the next question. So very interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway,
kind of indirect circumstantial evidence that something was going on with the Gemstone Files,
Yeah,
exactly.
Weird.
Yeah. Well, Al, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your schedule.
I know too.
You're very, very busy, and we threw a lot of stuff your way, and you weren't tipped off about any of it. So we.
I think the audience can be clear on that.
And you did fine.
Yeah,
you did wonderful.
Great.
And this stuff, we just eat it up. We love this kind of stuff, and it's good to be able to talk to somebody else that's versed.
Victor does it this way because he wants it to be fresh.
Uh-huh.
So we do this to everybody, so you're not alone.
That's fine. I appreciate what you guys are doing, boy, with your website, your broadcast, and everything else that you do. We really admire what you do as well.
Well, keep in touch with us, and if there's anything we can do, let us know. It's paranoiamagazine.com 3 times a year, available at your local newsstands and also at that website address. Also, back issues available. So, Elle, thanks once again, and keep up the good work, okay?
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
We'll be back again tomorrow on Wing TV. Until then, keep your eyes open because there's a lot going on.
See you later.